Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to the Bard's Grove.
Good evening. Welcome.
Hey, Lantern, how are you tonight?
Very good, my dear. Very good. Shining brightly.
Good.
How about yourself?
I'm doing fine. It's finally going to turn into fall here, and that's one of the most beautiful times. And so I thought I would start off right away because I had done this. I still have to finish the story from last week.
Okay.
So for those of you who listened last week, maybe you'll remember. For those of you who don't, I think we have it archived, but I'm telling the story of by George MacDonald called The Day Boy and the Night Girl. And just a quick synopsis, this witch named Watho enticed two women to come to her castle, and they both gave birth to a child. And the witch kept them. And the little boy, she called Photogen, and she only brought him up in the daylight. He never saw the dark. Meanwhile, he brought up the little girl named Nycteris in the dark, and she never saw the light. Well, the boy grew up, and he was about 16, and he was a great hunter, and he was never fearful of anything. The little girl grew up, and she found her way out of this cave-like room where she was practically imprisoned, and she discovered the earth under the moonlight, and she was very brave. And the little boy, the young man, was brave too, until one day he decided to stay out at night. And as soon as night came, he just broke down. And that's where we left him. He had come to the garden, and he had found Nycteris, and she was there taking care of him because she could see in the dark. She had always lived in the dark, so she could see, whereas he could see nothing, only brought up in the light. And she mistakes him for a girl, and this is where we left off last week. She says, come, my dear, you must not go on this way. You must be a brave girl. And a girl, shouted Photogen and started to his feet in wrath. If you were a man, I should kill you. A man, said Nycteris, what is that? How could I be that? We are both girls, aren't we? No, I am not a girl, he answered, although, he added, changing his tone and casting himself on the ground at her feet, I have given you too good a reason to call me one. Oh, I see, said Nycteris. No, of course, you can't be a girl. Girls are not afraid, without reason. I understand now. It is because you are not a girl that you are so frightened. Photogen twisted and writhed in the grass. No, it is not. It's this horrible darkness that creeps into me, goes all through me, into the very marrow of my bones. That's what makes me behave like a girl. If only the sun would shine. The sun, what is that? Cried Nycteris, now in her turn conceiving a vague fear. Then Photogen broke into a rhapsody in which he vainly sought to forget his. It's the soul, the life, the heart, the glory of the universe. The world dances like motes in his beams. The heart of man is strong and brave in his light. And when it departs, his courage grows from him, goes from him, goes with the sun, and he becomes such as you see me now. Pointing at the moon, Nycteris said, then that's not the sun? That, cried Photogen with utter scorn. I know nothing about that except that it's ugly and horrible. At best, it can only be the ghost of a dead sun. Yes, that's what it is. That's what makes it look so frightful. No, said Nycteris. You must be wrong there. I think the sun is the ghost of a dead moon, and that is how he is so much more splendid, as you say. Is there then another big room where the sun lives in the roof? I don't know what you mean, replied Photogen, but you mean to be kind, I know, though you should not call a poor fellow in the dark a girl. If you will let me lie here with my head in your lap, I should like to sleep. Will you watch over me and take care of me? Yes, I will, answered Nycteris, forgetting her own danger. So Photogen fell asleep. And there Nycteris sat, and the other youth lay all night long in the heart of the great cone shadow of the earth, like two pharaohs in one pyramid. Photogen slept and slept, and Nycteris sat motionless, lest she should wake him and so betray him to his fear. The moon rode high in the blue eternity. It was a very triumph, a glorious night. The river ran babble murmuring in deep, soft syllables. The fountain kept rushing moonward and blossoming momentarily to a great silvery flower whose petals were forever falling like snow. But with a continuous musical clash into the bed of its exhaustion beneath. The wind woke, took a run around the trees, and went to sleep, and then woke again. And the daisies slept on their feet at hers, but she didn't know that they slept. The roses might well seem awake, for their scent filled the air, but in truth they slept too, and the odor was that of their dreams. The oranges hung like gold lamps in the trees, and their silvery flowers were the souls of their yet unembodied children. The scent of the acacia blossoms filled the air, like the very odor of the moon herself. At last, unused to the living air and weary with sitting so still and so long, Nycteris grew drowsy. The air began to grow cool, and it was getting near the time when she too was accustomed to sleep. She closed her eyes just for a moment and nodded. Opened them suddenly wide awake, for she had promised to watch. And in that moment a change had come. The moon had got round and was fronting her from the west, and she saw that the moon's face was altered, that she had grown pale as if she too were wan with fear, and from her lofty place espied a coming terror. The light seemed to be dissolving out of her. She was dying, she was going out. And yet everything around looked strangely clear, clearer than ever Nycteris had seen anything before. How could the lamp be shedding more light when she herself had less? That was it. See how faint she looked? It was because the light was forsaking her and spreading it itself over this beautiful room, and so she looked like she was growing thin and pale. She was giving up everything. She was melting away from the roof like a bit of sugar in water. Nycteris was fast growing afraid and sought refuge with the face upon her lap. How beautiful this creature was. What to call it she couldn't think, for it had been angry when she called it what Watho called her. And wonder upon wonders, now even in the cold change that was passing upon the great room, the color was of a red rose as rising in the rain in his wan cheeks. What beautiful yellow hair he had that spread over her lap. What great, huge breaths the creature took. And what were those curious things it carried? She had seen them on her walls in the pictures, but she wasn't sure. Thus she talked to herself as the lamp of the moon grew paler and paler, and everything kept growing clearer and clearer. What could it mean? The lamp was dying, it was going out into the other place of which the creature in her lap had spoken, to be a sun. But why were the things growing clearer before it was yet a sun? That was the point. Was it her growing into a sun that did it? Yes, it was coming death. She knew it. It was coming upon her also. She felt it coming. What was she about to grow into? Something beautiful, maybe, like the creature in her lap. It just might be. Anyway, it must be death, for all her strength was going out of her while all around her was growing so light she could not bear it. She would be blind soon. She wondered if she would be blind or dead first. For the sun was rushing up behind her, and just then Photogen woke, lifted his head from her lap and sprang to his feet. His face was one radiant smile. His heart was full of daring. That of the hunter who will creep into the tiger's den. Nycteris gave a cry and covered her face with her hands and pressed her eyelids closed, and then blindly she stretched out her arms to Photogen, crying, "Oh, I'm so frightened. What is this? It must be death. I don't want to die yet. I love this room in the old lamp. I don't want to go to that other place. This is terrible. I want to hide. I want to get into the sweet, soft, dark hands of all the other creatures. Oh! What's the matter with you, girl?" said Photogen, with the arrogance all male creatures have until they've been caught by the other kind. He stood looking down at her, and he was examining his bow. "There is no fear of anything now, child. It's day. The sun is all but up. Look, he will be over the brow of the hill in one moment more. Goodbye. thank you for my night's lodging. I'm off. Don't be a silly goose if ever I can do anything for you. And, you know, all that. Don't leave me. Don't leave me, cried Nycteris. I'm dying. I'm dying. I can't move. The light sucks all the strength out of me. Oh, I'm so frightened. But already Photogen had splashed through the river, holding high his bow so it wouldn't get wet. He rushed across the level and strained up the opposing hill. Hearing no answer, Nycteris removed her hands. Photogen had reached the top of the hill, and at that moment the sun rays alighted upon him. The glory of the King of Day crowded, blazing upon the golden-haired youth. Radiant as Apollo, he stood in mighty strength, a flashing shape in the mist of flame. He lifted a glowing arrow to a gleaming bow. The arrow parted with a keen, musical twang of the bowstring, and Photogen, darting after it, vanished with a shout. Up shot Apollo himself, and from his quiver scattered astonishment and exultation. But the brain of poor Nycteris was pierced through and through. She fell down in utter darkness. All around her was a flaming furnace. In despair and feebleness and agony, she crept back, feeling her way with doubt and difficulty, and enforced persistence to her dark cell. When at last the friendly darkness of her chamber folded her about with its cooling and consoling arms, she threw herself on her bed and fell fast asleep. And there she slept on, one alive in a tomb, while Photogen above in the sunlit glory pursued the buffaloes on the lofty plain, thinking not once of her where she lay dark and forlorn. He was in his glory and his pride, and the darkness and its disgrace had vanished for a time. But no sooner had the sun reached noon than Photogen began to remember the past night in the shadow and remember it with shame. He had proved himself, and not to himself only, but to a girl as well. He was a coward. He was bold in the daylight when there was nothing to fear, but he trembled when the night arrived. There was something unfair about it. A spell had been cast upon him. He had eaten, he had drunk something that was not... that did not agree with courage. Well, in any case, he had been taken unprepared. How was he to know what was going down, what the going down of the sun would be like? He had never seen it before. No wonder why he was afraid. He didn't know what dangers there were. Every possible excuse he caught at, eager as a self-lover to lighten his self-contempt. That day he astonished the other huntsmen. In fact, terrorized them with his reckless daring, all to prove to himself that he was no coward. But nothing could ease his shame. One thing only had hope in it, it was a resolve to encounter the dark once again, now that he knew something about it. It was nobler to meet a recognized danger than to rush contemptuously into what seemed nothing. Nobler still to encounter a nameless horror. He could conquer fear and wipe out the disgrace together. He knew the darkness now, and when it came, he would meet it fearlessly and cool as he now felt himself. And once again, he said, "We shall see." And so he stood under the boughs of a great beech as the sun was going down far away over the jagged hills. Before it was half down, he was trembling like one of the leaves behind him in the first sigh of the night wind. The moment the last of the glowing disc vanished, he bounded away in terror to gain the valley, and his fear grew as he ran down the side of the hill. An abject creature, he went bounding and rolling and running, fell rather than plunged into the river, and came to himself as before, lying on the grassy bank in the garden. But when he opened his eyes, there was no girl eyes looking down at him. There were only the stars in the waste of the sunless night. The awful all enemy he had again dared but could not encounter. Perhaps the girl was not yet come out of the water. Well, he would try to sleep, for he dared not move, and perhaps when he woke he would find his head in her lap and the beautiful dark face with its deep blue eyes bending over him. But when he woke, he found his head in the grass, and although he sprang up with all his courage, such as it was restored, he did not set out for the chase with as much courage as before, and despite the sun glorying in his heart and veins, his hunting that day was less eager. He ate little, and from the first was thoughtful even unto sadness. A second time he was defeated and disgraced. Was his courage nothing more than the play of sunlight on his brain? Was he a mere ball tossed between the light and dark? Then what a poor, contemptuous creature he was. But a third chance lay before him. If he failed the third time, he dared not look at himself again. But alas, it went no better. The moment the sun went down, he fled as if a legion of devils were after him. Seven times in all, he tried to face the coming night with the strength of the past day, and seven times he failed. Now, the evil witch Watha was ill herself, as I've said, and was so much more worse-tempered. And besides, it's a peculiarity of witches that what works in others to sympathy works in them to repulsion. Also, Watha had a poor, helpless, rudimentary spleen of a conscience left, just enough to make her uncomfortable and therefore more wicked. So when she heard that Photogen was ill, she was angry. Ill indeed, after all she'd done to saturate him with the life of the sun himself. He was a wretched failure, that boy. And because he was her failure, she was annoyed with him and began to dislike him and grew to hate him. She looked on him as a painter might upon a picture or a poet upon a poem, which he had only succeeded in getting into an irrecoverable mess. For you see, in the hearts of witches, love and hate lie close together and often tumble over each other. And whether it was her failure with Photogen that foiled her plans in regard to Nycteris, or that her illness made her yet more wicked, certainly Watho now got sick of the girl too and hated to know that she was about the castle. But Watho was not too ill to go to poor Photogen's room and torment him. She told him she hated him like a serpent and hissed like one as she said it, looking very sharp in the nose and chin and flat in the forehead. Photogen thought that she meant to kill him and hardly ventured to take anything that was brought to him. She ordered every ray of light to be shut out of his room, but by means of this he got a little used to the darkness. She would take one of his arrows and tickle him with the feather end of him or prick him with the point until blood ran down. What she meant finally to do I can't tell you, but she brought Photogen speedily up to the determination to make his escape. What he should do then, he would think of afterwards. Who could tell, but he might find his mother somewhere beyond the forest. But as he lay in the dark, all he could think of was that beautiful face that he had seen that one night in the garden. Would he ever see her again? Well, from that dreadful morning that Nycteris had never got to be herself again, the sudden light had been like a death to her, and she lay in the dark, scared and trembling. Before long, Watho was plotting evil against her. The witch was like a sick child, weary of his toy. She would pull her to pieces and see how she liked it. She would set her in the sun and see her die like jelly from the salt ocean cast up on a hot rock. That would be a sight that would soothe her wolfish pain. One day, therefore, a little before noon, while Nycteris was in her deepest sleep, she had a dark litter brought to the door, and in that she made two of her men carry Nycteris out to the plain. There they took her, laid her on the grass, and left her. Watho watched it all from the top of her high tower through her telescope. And scarcely had Nycteris left when she saw her sit up and at the same moment cast herself down with her face on the ground. "She'll have sunstroke," laughed Watho, "and that'll be the end of her." Presently, tormented by a fly, a huge humped buffalo with great shaggy manes came galloping along straight to where Nycteris lay. At the sight of the thing in the grass, the buffalo started, swerved, and stopped dead, and then came up to her, looking malicious. Nycteris lay quite still and never even saw the animal. "Ha!" said Watho, looking through her telescope. "Now she'll be trod to death. That's the way those creatures do it." But when the buffalo reached her, he sniffed her all over and went away. After that, many wild animals came to her, but no creature hurt her, and Watho was angry with all of creation. At length, in the shade of her hair, the blue eyes of Nycteris began to come to themselves a little, and the first thing they saw brought her comfort. For you see, she saw the beautiful flowers that were in the meadow all around her. And even though the sun was out and it was burning her, she could see the beauty of the flowers. Well, she didn't know what to think and what to do. And she thought this room was quite big, so she better lay still. And so she did. Well, fixing her telescope on that motionless form, Watho thought she might see what would happen when morning came. So Watho went down from the tower to Photogen's room. He was much better by this time, and before she left him, he had resolved to leave the castle that very night. Boy, the darkness was terrible indeed, but Watho was worse than even the darkness, and he couldn't escape in the day. So, as soon as the house was still, he tightened his belt, took up his hunting knife, took a flask of wine and some bread in his pocket and his bows and arrows, and he got out of his house and he made his way to the plain. But with the terror that he had of the night, he just got to a part where he couldn't walk, and he just sat down and he thought it's better to die, and he fell asleep. He hadn't been slept long when he woke up, for there was some kind of comfort around, but what was it? It was the girl. She had found him in the darkness. "Thank you," he said. "You're like live armor to my heart. You keep this fear off of me. I've been very ill since then. Did you come up out of the river when you saw me come across?" "I don't live in the river," Nycteris said. "I live under this pale lamp, and I die under the bright one." "Ah, yes, I understand now," said Photogen. "I would not have behaved as I did last time if I had understood, but I thought you were mocking me, and I am so made that I can't help being frightened at the darkness. I beg your pardon for leaving you as I did, for, as I say, I didn't understand. Now, I believe you were really frightened, right?" "Oh, yes, I was, and I'll be again. But I don't understand why you should be. You must know how gentle and sweet the darkness is, how kind and friendly, how soft and velvety. It holds you to its bosom, and it loves you. A little while ago, I lay faint and dying under your hot lamp. What is it you call it?" "The sun," murmured Photogen. "How I wish he would make haste and come again." "Don't wish that, don't, for my sake. I can take care of you in the darkness, but I have no one to take care of me from that big light. You see, I was telling you, I was laying dying in the sun. All at once I knew, I drew a deep breath, and a cool wind came, and it ran over my face. I looked up, and the torture was gone, for that death lamp itself was gone. I hope he does not die and grow brighter yet. My terrible headache's all gone, and my sight is coming back. I felt as if I'd been made anew. But I did not get up at once, for I was still tired. The grass grew cool around me, and it turned soft. Everything wet came up, and now it's so pleasant to my feet that I rose up and I ran about. And that's when I came upon you." "How good you are, you beautiful creatures," cried Photogen. "Why, you forgave me before I even asked you." And so they fell to talking, and they told each other their histories and how Watho was trying to kill them. "We must get out of her way right away." And Photogen said, "Well, the moment the morning comes." And Nycteris said, "We can't wait till the morning, for then I won't be able to move. And what will you do the next night? Besides, Watho sees best in the daytime. At least, come on, you have to come now. You must." Photogen just was scared. "I can't, I dare not, I can't move. If I but lift my head from your lap, the sickness of terror seizes me." But Nycteris said, "I will be with you. I'll take care of you till that dreadful sun comes, and then you can leave me and go away as fast as you can. Only please put me in a dark place first, if there is one to be found." "I will never leave you again, Nycteris," cried Photogen. "Only wait till the sun comes and brings me back my strength, and we'll go away together and never, never be parted again." "No, no, no, we must go now, and you must learn to be strong in the dark as well in the day as the day, else you will always be only half brave. I've already begun, not to fight your son, but to try to get at peace with him and understand what he really is and what he means to do to me, whether to hurt me or to make the best of me. You must do the same with my darkness." But you don't know what mad animals will be here. They have huge green eyes and they eat you up. Oh, no, come. I will be able to protect you. Come on, you must go or I'll pretend to leave you. I'll make you come that way. I can see those green eyes before they even come near us. You, how can you do that? If it were day, I could take care of you, but as it is, I can't see in this darkness. Well, you either will come or I'm going to go. And so they both decided to take off after this argument. So in the dark, Photogen leaned on Nycteris and went away. The piercing night eyes of Nycteris could see everything, and so she kept him safe all through the night. When morning began to come, Photogen grew better but was dreadfully tired from walking instead of sleeping. Nycteris, who had been supporting him, was growing very tired indeed, but also full of fear because the light was starting to come. And so, embracing each other, they stood in the midst of a wide grassy land, neither of them able to move another step, supporting each other, ready to fall down if one would move. But while one grew weaker, the other had begun to grow stronger. When the tide of night began to ebb and the tide of day began to flow and the sun rushed over the horizon, Photogen revived. Even though Nycteris cried in pain and hid her face, "Oh me, I'm so frightened. That terrible light stings so." But in the next instant, through her blindness, she heard Photogen give a low, exultant laugh. And the next, she felt herself caught up in his strong arms. She who had all night tended him and protected him like a child was now in his arms, borne along like a baby with her head lying on his shoulder. But she was the greater, her suffering more, she feared nothing. At the very moment when Photogen caught up Nycteris, the telescope of Watho was angrily sweeping the tableland. She swept it from her in a rage and, running from the room, shut herself up. Then she anointed herself from head to toe with an ointment. She shook her long red hair down, and when she turned around, she was the wolf. As the sun rose, the wind slowly changed and went around until it blew straight from the north. Photogen and Nycteris were drawing near the edge of the forest when Nycteris murmured in his ears, "I smell a wild beast that way, the way the wind is coming from." Well, Photogen turned and looked back towards the castle and saw a dark speck on the plain. As he looked, it grew larger. It was coming across the grass with the speed of the wind. It came nearer and nearer. It looked long and low, but that might be because it was running at a great stretch. He set Nycteris down under a tree in the black shadow of its bole, strung his bow, picked up his heaviest, longest, sharpest arrow. Just as he set the notch to the string, he saw that the creature was a tremendous wolf rushing straight at him. He loosed his knife in its sheath, drew another arrow halfway from the quiver, lest the first should fail, and took aim. It was still a good distance, and it left time for a second chance. He shot. The arrow rose, flew straight, descended, and struck the beast, and started again into the air. Quickly, Photogen snatched up the other, shot, and cast his bow from him and drew his knife. But the arrow was in the brute's chest, up to the feather. It tumbled head over heels in a great thud, lay moaning, and then stretched out motionless. "I've killed it, Nycteris," cried Photogen. "It's a great red wolf." "Oh, thank you," said Nycteris feebly. "I was sure you would. I was not a bit afraid." Photogen went up to the wolf. It was a monster, but he was vexed that his first arrow had behaved badly, and so it was hard to pull the second arrow out of the brute's chest. But then, could he believe his eyes? There lay not a wolf, but Watho, with her hair tied around her waist. The foolish witch had made herself vulnerable, but had forgotten that Photogen was a great hunter. Well, now all was well. There was now no occasion to go further. Neither of them feared anyone but Watho. They left her there and went back to the castle. A great cloud came over the sun and rain began to fall heavily. And Nycteris was much refreshed, and she grew able to see a little. and with Photogen's help, walked gently over the cool, wet grass. They had not gone far before they met the servant Fargu and the other huntsmen. Photogen told them he had killed a great red wolf and that it was Madame Watho. The huntsman looked grave, but gladness shone through. Then said Fargu, "I will go and bury my mistress." But when they reached the place, they found that she was already buried in the maws of sundry beasts and birds that had made their breakfast on her. Then Fargu, overtaking them, would very wisely have Photogen go to the king and tell him the whole story. But Photogen, yet wiser than Fargu, would not set out until he had married Nycteris. For then, he said, the king himself cannot part us. And if ever two people couldn't do the one without the other, those two are Nycteris and I. She has to teach me to be a brave man in the dark, and I have got to look after her until she can bear the heat of the sun, and he helps her to see instead of blinding her. And so they were married that very next day. The next day they set out together to the king, and when they arrived at his castle, told him the whole story. And whom should they find at the court but Photogen's mother and father, both in high favor with the king and the queen. Aurora nearly died for joy and told them all how Watho had lied to her and made her believe that her child was dead. No one knew anything about the father or mother of Nycteris, but when Aurora saw in the lovely girl her own azure blue eyes shining through night and its clouds, it made her think strange things and wonder how even the wicked themselves may be a link to join together the good. Through Watho, the mothers, who had never seen each other, had changed eyes in their children. The king gave them the castle and the lands of Watho, and there they lived and taught each other for many years, but hardly had one of them passed before Nycteris had come to love the day best, because it was the clothing and crown of Photogen. And she saw that the day was greater than the night and the sun more lordly than the moon. And Photogen had come to love the night best because it was the mother and home of Nycteris. But who knows, said Nycteris, that when we go out, we shall not go into a day as much greater than your day is than to you. Excuse me, we will go into a day as much greater than your day as your day is greater than my night. And so ends the tale of the day boy and the night girl by George MacDonald.
What a wonderful story. Thank you.
Yes, George, as I said before, George MacDonald is one of the grandfathers of modern fantasy. And he wrote beautifully spiritual, magical stories, of which this is just one.
Well, very lovely. Very lovely.
Good. So, do you have any stories?
Well, I do. I do, as a matter of fact. And since we've entered the cosmic scheme of Libra, I thought that we should look at the great ancient goddesses of justice. So I first have prepared some stories about Maat, the goddess of physical and moral law of ancient Egypt. She's also the goddess of order and truth. She is said to be the wife of Thoth, the father of writing, the scribe, the father of magic. The most important of Maat's children was Amon. The eight children they had were the chief gods of Hermopolis, and according to the priests there, they created the earth and all that was in it. Maat is depicted in the form of a woman, seated or standing. She holds the scepter in one hand and the ankh in the other. The symbol of Maat was the ostrich feather, and she is always shown wearing it in her hair. In some pictures, she has a pair of wings attached to her arms. Occasionally, she is shown as a woman with an ostrich feather for a head. Another symbol of Maat is the primeval mound upon which the creator god stood at the beginning of time. It was when the world was created and chaos was eliminated that the principles of Maat were set in place. The Egyptians believed that if the pharaoh ever failed to live by and maintain Maat, that chaos would return to Egypt and the world and all would be destroyed. Thus, the pharaohs of Egypt saw it as their cosmic role to uphold the principles of Maat, and was due to Maat that the pharaohs had the authority to rule the land. Amenhotep stated that Maat was placed upon his breast by Amun himself. Akhenaten, the heretic king, who was accused of deviating from the laws of his successors, repeatedly emphasized his adherence to Maat on many of his monuments. Here's how the legend goes. When the dead were judged, it was the feather of Maat that their hearts were weighed against. If the heart of the deceased was as light as a feather, they were granted eternal life in the Duat. The near weightlessness of their hearts indicated that their souls were not burdened with sin and evil. If their hearts did not measure up, did not balance with the feather of Maat, the feather of truth, the soul of the deceased was consumed by Amut. This judgment occurred in the hall of the two truths. The last role of Maat was to help guide the sun god Ra as he made his journey across the sky. It was she that determined the course that his boat took across the sky each day. It was sometimes said that she actually traveled in his boat with him, guiding his direction. It is generally translated that which is straight, or truth, and also implies order and balance and justice. Thus Maat personified perfect order and harmony. She came into being when Ra rose from the waters of chaos. And so she was often described as the daughter of Ra. She was sometimes considered to be the wife of Thoth, because he was the god of wisdom. The ancient Egyptians believed that the universe was ordered and rational. The rising and setting of the sun, the flooding of the Nile, and the predictable course of the stars in the sky reassured them that there was permanence to existence, which was central to the nature of all things. However, the forces of chaos were always present and threatened the balance of Maat. Each person was duty-bound to preserve and defend Maat, and the pharaoh was perceived as the guardian of Maat. Without Maat, Nun, or chaos, would reclaim the universe, and chaos would again reign supreme. The Egyptians also had a strong sense of morality and justice. They felt that the good should prosper, and the guilty be punished. They praised those who defended the weak and the poor and placed a high value on loyalty, especially to one's family. However, they also understood that it was not possible to be perfect, just balanced. Maat transcended specific ethical rules, which differed according to different times and different peoples, and instead focused on the natural order of things. That being said, certain actions were clearly against Maat as they increased the effect of chaos and had a purely negative effect on the world. Each Egyptian soul was judged in the Hall of Maat, depicted in the Book of the Dead and Book 5 of the Book of Gates, when they died. Their heart, or conscience, was weighed against the feather of Maat on scales which represented balance and justice. If their heart was heavier than the feather, because they had failed to live a balanced life by the principles of Maat in their heart, it was thrown into a lake of fire or devoured by a fearsome deity known as Amut. If, however, the heart balanced with the feather of Maat, it would pass the test and gain eternal life. At certain times, it was Osiris who sat in judge of the ritual, and many other deities were involved in the ceremony, but the scales always represented Maat. Ancient Egyptians had a well-developed legal system To ensure that Maat was preserved in daily life, it is thought that the priests of Maat were involved in the justice system as well as tending to the needs of the goddess. All rulers respected Maat, but Akhenaten in particular emphasized his adherence to Maat, despite or perhaps because of his rather unconventional approach to the gods. Heshtaput also emphasized her reverence for Maat by taking the throne name Maat-Kahare, justice in the soul of Ra. Again, possibly because as a female ruler, she needed to show that her position was in line with Maat. She also built a small temple to Maat within the precincts of Mentu in Karnak. Maat is depicted often as a woman wearing a crown with a single ostrich feather. She is occasionally depicted as a winged goddess. Her totem was a stone platform representing the stable foundation on which order was built, and the primeval mound which first emerged from the waters of Nun, chaos. These are called the 42 principles of Maat. Number 1, I have not killed nor bid anyone kill. Number 2, I have not committed adultery or rape. Number 3, I have not avenged myself nor burned with rage. Number 4, I have not caused terror. Number 5, I have not assaulted anyone nor caused anyone pain. Number 6, I have not caused misery. Number 7, I have not done any harm to man or to animals. Number 8, I have not caused the shedding of tears. Number 9, I have not wronged a people nor borne them any evil intent. Number 10, I have not stolen or taken that which does not belong to me. Number 11, I have not taken more than my fair share of food. Number 12, I have not damaged the crops, the fields, or the trees. 13, I have not deprived anyone of what is rightfully theirs. Number 14, I have not borne false witness nor supported false allegations. Number 15, I have not lied nor spoken falsely to the hurt of another. Number 16, I have not used fiery words nor stirred up any strife. Number 17, I have not spoken nor acted deceitfully to the hurt of others. Number 18, I have not spoken scornfully against others. Number 19, I have not eavesdropped. Number 20, I have not ignored the truth or words of righteousness. 21, I have not judged anyone hastily or harshly. 22, I have not disrespected sacred places. 23, I have caused no wrong to be done to any workers or prisoners. 24, I have not been angry without good reason. 25, I have not hindered the flow of running water. 26, I have not wasted the running water. 27, I have not polluted the water or the land. 28, I have not taken the God's name in vain. 29, I have not despised nor angered the gods. 30, I have not stolen from God. 31, I have not given excessive offerings nor less than what is due. 32, I have not coveted thy neighbor's goods. 33, I have not stolen from nor disrespected the dead. 34, I have remembered and observed the appointed holy days. 35, I have not held back the due offerings of the gods. 36, I have not interfered with the sacred rites. 37, I have not slaughtered with evil intent any sacred animals. 38, I have not acted with guile or insolence. 39, I have not been unduly proud nor acted with arrogance. 40, I have not magnified my condition beyond what is appropriate. 41, I have done no less than my daily obligations require. 42, I have obeyed the law and committed no treason. A wonderful set of rules that still might do us good.
Most definitely. I love the thing about not polluting the water.
I thought that was pretty good myself. The mistreatment of prisoners, I think that some of that would go pretty good even now, don't you think?
Yeah, I wonder if maybe the fact that we don't value anything in our culture is part of the problem. Even, you know, we say we are for law and justice, but are we really? Perhaps if our sense of law was more divine, we would want to hold on to it better, rather than just the church's way of talking about it, but just understanding that there are certain cosmic laws that we all need to live by.
It just seems so amazing to me that here we're listening to the thoughts, to the idea of justice, 2,000 or 3,000 years old, and how little different it is from the men and women of today.
Right.
How useful, how timely, how timeless.
Definitely.
Well,
since
we're talking about justice and Libra, I also sought out information on the Greek goddess Themis. Let me read you a little bit about Themis.
Okay.
The modern image of justice is a conflation of various images in iconography over a period of time. The sword and the blindfold being two of the images that would have been alien to antiquity. But here's some information on the Greek and Roman goddesses and personifications of justice. Themis, one of the Titans, the old gods, the children of Uranus, sky, and Gaia, earth. In Homer, Themis appears three times where her role, according to Timothy Gans in the early Greek myth, is that of imposing some kind of order or control over gatherings. Sometimes Themis is called the mother of the Morai and of the Horai, Dike, justice, and Irina, peace, and Eunomia, lawful government. Themis was either first or second to deliver oracles at Delphi, an office she gave over to Apollo. In this role, Themis prophesied that the son of the nymph Thetis would be greater than its father. Until the prophecy, Zeus and Poseidon had been trying to win Thetis, but afterwards they led her to Peleus, who became the mortal father of the great Greek hero Achilles. Dike and Astraea. Dike was the Greek goddess of justice. She was one of the Horai, and the daughters of Themis and Zeus. Dike had a valued place in Greek literature. Passages from the Theai Project describe her physically holding a staff and a balance. If some god had been holding level the balance of Dike, a beautiful woman is seen publishing an ugly one, choking her with one hand and with the other striking her with a staff. It is Dike justice who thus treats Edikiai injustice that way. Dike is described as almost indistinguishable from Astraea, who is depicted with a torch, wings, and Zeus's thunderbolts. Justia. Iustia, or Justia, was the Roman personification of justice. She was a virgin living among humans until the wrongdoings of mortals forced her to take flight and become the constellation Virgo, according to the Achilles in Dictionary of Roman Religion. On a coin depicting Justicia from 22 AD, she is a regal woman wearing a diadem. In another, Justicia carries an olive twig, patera, and a scepter. Lady Justice. The U.S. Supreme Court website explains some of the images of Lady Justice that adorn Washington, D.C. Lady Justice is a blend of Themis and Justicia. The blindfold, which justice is now associated, probably started in the 16th century. In some of the Washington, D.C. statues, justice holds scales, blindfolds, and swords. In one representation, she is fighting evil with her gaze, although her sword is still sheathed. Besides all the statues of Lady Justice, Themis and Justicia, in courtrooms across the U.S. and world, the most revered Statue of Liberty bears a close resemblance to the ancient goddess of justice. The family of Themis. Themis was the daughter of Gaia and Uranus, along with her brother Titans Cronus, Oceanus, Hyperion, Iapetus, Creus, Curius, and the sisters Tethys, Thea, Phoebe, and Mnemosyne, according to Hesiod. As the second wife of Zeus, Themis was mother to the Horai, seasons, Irene, peace, Eunomia, good order, and Dike, justice, the Morai, the fates, Clotho, Lachesis, and Atropos. Some say the Morai were present at the marriage of Zeus and Themis. Themis is sometimes called the mother of Prometheus. It's an interesting reference there, huh?
Yeah.
Goddess of prophecy. Themis was the first deity of prophecy and in charge of the Delphic oracles until she gave it to Apollo. Themis, interesting, justice and prophecy, right?
Yes.
Themis was the one who predicted to Zeus that if he married Thetis, the nymph mother of Achilles, his son would be greater than the father. The goddess of divine law. Themis was the goddess of divine law and sat beside Zeus to offer advice. Themis was the Greek personification of divine law. Iustitia, whence our justice, was the Roman goddess equated with Themis. Blindfolded goddess Themis. Themis judged whether the dead went to Tartarus or the Elysian fields. When people were assigned to Tartarus, the Erinyes took them. When alive, those who thwarted Themis were visited by the Nemesis, personification of or goddess of divine retribution. Themis is now depicted as blindfolded, so as to be impartial. And to wrap up my little adventure tonight, I've got some a little more lighthearted takes, just as jokes. This is from a Palestinian joke. A weaver closed his shop for the night, and he left a long needle sticking in his work on the loom. A thief got in with a false key, and as he was stumbling about in the dark, the needle put out one of his eyes. He went out again and locked the door behind him. The next morning, he told his story to Karkash, the impartial judge, who sent for the weaver and, eyeing him sternly, asked, "Did you leave a packing needle in the cloth on your loom when you shut your shop last night?" "Yes," he said. "Well, this poor thief has lost his eye through your carelessness. He was going to rob your shop, but he stumbled and the needle pierced his eye. Am I not Karkash, the impartial judge? This poor thief has lost an eye through your fault, so you shall lose an eye in a like manner." "But, my lord," said the weaver, "he came to rob me. He had no right there." "Oh, we are not concerned with what this robber came to do, but just what he did. Was your shop door broken or damaged this morning? Was anything missing?" "No." "Well, he's done you no harm then, and you do add insult to injury by throwing up his way of life against him. Justice demands that you lose an eye." The weaver offered money to the robber, to the cat eye, but in vain. The impartial judge would not be moved. At last, a bright thought struck him, and he said, "An eye for an eye is justice, O my lord, the cat eye. Yet, in this case, it's not quite fair on me. You are the impartial judge, and I submit to you that being a married man with three children shall suffer more damage in the loss of an eye than this poor robber, who has no one dependent on him. How can I go on weaving but with one eye? But I have a good neighbor, a gunsmith, who is a single man. Let one of his eyes be put out. What does he want with two eyes for looking at gun barrels?" The impartial judge, struck with the justice of these arguments, sent for the gunsmith and had his eyes put out.
Sounds like today. I have a little tiny story called The Story of the Fairy Tale by Carl Ewald, and I think it has a lot to do with some of the things we're talking about. So in the last few minutes, I'd like to tell that story, if that's okay.
By all means, my dear, by all means.
Okay. Once upon a time, ever so many years ago, truth suddenly vanished from out of the world. When people perceived this, they were greatly alarmed and at once sent five wise men in search of truth. They set out, one in this direction and one in that, all plentifully equipped with traveling expenses and good intentions. They sought for 10 long years. Then they returned each separately. While still at a distance, they waved their hats and shouted that they had found truth. The first stepped forward and declared that truth was science. He was not able to finish his report, however, for before he had done, another thrust him aside and shouted that that was a lie, that truth was theology and that he had found it. Now, while these two were at loggerheads for science, the science man replied to the attack vigorously, there came a third and said, in beautiful words, that love was truth without a doubt. Then came the fourth and stated quite curtly that he had truth in his pocket, and that was gold, and that all the rest was childish nonsense. At last came the fifth. He could not stand on his legs, and he gurgled while he laughed and said truth was wine. He had found the truth in wine after looking everywhere else. Then the five wise men began to fight, and they pummeled one another so lustily it was horrible to see. Science had its head broken, and love was so greatly ill-treated that it had to change its clothes before it could show itself again in respectful society. Gold was so thoroughly stripped of every covering that people felt awkward about knowing it, and the bottle broke and wine flowed away into the mud. But theology came off worst of all. Everyone had a blow at it, and it received such a basting that it became the laughing stock of all beholders. And people took sides, some with this one and some with that, and they shouted so loud they could neither see nor hear because of the din. But far away at the extreme end of the earth sat a few and mourned because they thought the truth had gone to pieces and would never be made whole again. Now as they sat there, a little girl came running up and said she had found the truth. If they would just come with her, it was not very far. Truth was sitting in the middle of the world in a green meadow. Then there came a great pause in the fighting, for the little girl looked so very sweet. First one went with her, and then another, and even more. At last they were all in the meadow, and there they discovered a figure, the like of which they had never seen before. There was no distinguishing whether it was a man or a woman, an adult or a child. Its forehead was pure as that of one who knows no sin, its eyes deep and serious as those of one who has read into the heart of the whole world. Its mouth opened with the brightest smile and then quivered with a sadness greater than any could describe. Its hands were soft as a mother's and strong as the hand of a king. Its foot trod the earth firmly that crushed not a flower. And then the figure had large, soft wings like the birds that fly at night. Now as they stood there and stared, the figure drew itself erect and cried in a voice that sounded like bells ringing, "I am truth." "It's a fairy tale," cried science. "It's a fairy tale," cried theology, "and love and gold and wine." Then the five wise men and their followers went away, and they continued to fight until the world was shaken at its center. But a few old and weary men and a few young men with ardent and eager souls, and many women, and thousands of children with great wide eyes, these remained in the meadow where the fairy tale was. The Story of the Fairy Tale by Carl Ewald.
Well, that was lovely.
That was great. I thought, yeah, truth has vanished from our world, and perhaps it is in our great old stories that we will find it once again.
I'm sure of that. So tell me, Kat, you're going on a journey, aren't you?
Yes, I am going away for the next 3 weeks or 4 weeks. So, Lantern, you're going to have to hold down the Bard's Grove. I will be thinking of you and on Friday evenings, although I'll probably be asleep since I'll be on a whole other continent. But keep up the stories, most definitely.
Well, I hope you find a wonderful old bookshop and just discover some amazing stories there. I know you'll be looking. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Well, and I hope you all return to the Bard's Grove. Our programs are archived, aren't they?
Absolutely.
Okay. So anyway, the archives are there. If you enjoyed the stories tonight, please tell your friends. Also, if you enjoyed the George MacDonald story, the beginning was on last week. And so, merry meet.
And merry part.
And merry meet again. Till the next time at the Bard's Grove. Good night.
Good night, Kat.
Good night, Lantern.
See you all soon. Join us next week, the Bard's Grove. Same time, same place. Good night. we go.